raised in a land much beset by conflict and turmoil. So, perhaps this impulse is only natural. But although I do not understand why the Duke's rough treatment should have convinced you to marry him, I will say this. The Duke is most valuable to my estate and to the safety of our realm, and I want your alliance to go ahead. The fact that you and William appear to be so much in love is a gift to a father, no matter how unusual the circumstances of your betrothal, and he appears to be a clever and wise man, far beyond the scope of his years. He paused. But you must understand that if you should go ahead with this without the approval of the Church, then it may lead to our enemies and enemies of William's using that defiance as a just reason to move against us, and to inspire others too as well. I could hear him running his hands through his hair. Your desire to marry this man may cause more wars to be fought. Does the Duke send messages as to his own thoughts on the matter? I did not turn around. I wanted to know what William's thoughts were. I did not care for my father's fears. He does, and if a man was to press any more anger into a page, I would think it would catch on fire. I turned from the window to see a smile hovering on the edges of my father's lips. He does love you a great deal, my dear, to be as enraged as he is here, on this missive. As I love him, I said, with all seriousness, and held out a hand. May I see? My father looked through the stacks of parchment on the table, found the missive from William, and handed it to me. I saw William's own hand, each word pressed so hard into the pages that in places the thick, creamy parchment had almost torn. I smiled to see it, imagining his wrath and cherishing it, for it was all for love of me that he was so enraged. "If you would listen to my advice, child," continued my father, "and if the Duke will, I would attempt to reason with the Papal Council first, before anything else is done." "And if that does not work?" My father lifted his shoulders. "I will not say that this decision, if it stands, will not give us some problems. It may well cause those opposed to us to find excuse to rebel or invade. But..." I looked up at him from the missive. "But what, my lord father?" "But what is the life of a ruler, if not fraught with endless problems?" my father asked with a sudden, almost malicious grin. "The Pope is but one man, and if his choices are, here, influenced not by the will of God, but that of man, then he is no more or less than any other ruler in this world, and I will not be dictated to by other rulers. They see us growing powerful, they dread our union with Normandy. That is their problem. My concerns will be the defense of my realm and my right to choose my daughter's husband." I stared at him, then, quite suddenly, broke into a run and embraced my father. Startled, but pleased, he wrapped his arms around me and pulled me close, kissing the top of my head. "Besides," he said as I pulled back, beaming at him, "this man is the only thing I have ever seen to make you so happy. What father could deny his daughter such contentment in life?" 2 days later, William came riding back to our court. I went out to meet him as before. As he dismounted, I could see his eyes searching here and there, looking for me. I ran towards him. His face was dark with frustration and anger, but as he saw me, his expression seemed to lighten. He went to bow to me, but I walked straight into his arms and laid my head to his great chest. His arms enveloped me and held me against him. Eventually, I looked up into his face, His eyes that had been closed in our embrace opened, and we stared at each other. "I have missed you," I said quietly, listening to the sound of the birds as they dipped and bowed in the skies. "Do not leave for so long again." His eyes gazed warmly at me. "I missed you too," he said, "more than I would have thought possible. Everywhere I went, I kept feeling as though I had misplaced something, until I realized it was because you were not beside me." I smiled. We released each other, and he kissed my hand, since he was not supposed to kiss my lips in public. "Is there any further news on the Pope's ruling?" I asked. William's face fluttered with fresh darkness. His eyes narrowed and flattened as though he were a cat waiting to pounce. "Fool," he exclaimed, causing me to giggle at his flagrant lack of respect, a lack I, too, felt in my heart. "The Pope is a craven fool, hiding behind his skirts like a feeble crone." "He will not relent." "He will not." William paused. "But come, let us go inside, and then I might talk to you and your father at the same time. Has—" He broke off from his sentence, looking at me uncertainly. "My lord?" "I feared that this ruling of the Papal Council may have affected your decision to marry me," he asked, anxiously. "As you are a lady of a Christian household, of noble bearing." "All that is true," I agreed. "But I believe also that God gives us signs to allow us to interpret our own way in his world, and he has given me one to marry you." I smiled wickedly and put my hands to my breast. What kind of Christian woman would I be to refuse the sign and symbol of my own God when he presents me with it? William let out a sigh of happiness. "Then your wishes are unaffected?" "My desire to marry you, my lord, only grows stronger by the day." In spite of the people in the courtyard watching, William grabbed me and pulled me to him in a fast embrace and fierce kiss. He almost pulled me off my feet, but I did not mind. Pulled up against him, his body damp with sweat, I felt my inside start to slowly melt as I became dazed from the feeling of him close to me. All the court was speaking of it later. What a scandal for a lord to kiss the woman he has promised to, in the full view of the court. I laughed when my maids questioned me on it that night as they brushed my hair and dressed me for bed. "He will be my husband and lord soon enough," I promised them, "and so there is no scandal in our behavior." The next day, before the glowing fire in my father's chamber, William relayed his tale to us. "I sent my bishops, including my close adviser, Bishop L'Enfant, to the Pope to try to reason with him." William sat, his hands cupped around a goblet of warm spiced wine. His face was lit by the fire, into which he glared with baleful eyes. "But it came to nothing. The Pope utterly refused to give his sanction." "I understood that L'Enfant opposed the match as well," my father questioned. William allowed his lips a brief smile. "I have reasoned with him, and now he supports us, my lord." "My father believes the Pope is under the influence of lords who would be enemies to our lands." I moved to fill William's goblet with more wine from the silver flagon which sat beside the hearth. "If the Pope acts not with the authority granted to him by God, but is influenced instead by mere men, then why should we listen to him? I say such a man is a false servant of our Lord, and does not represent the thoughts or will of God in this world." William looked at my father, who, like him, sat before the fire in a great chair, nursing his own goblet in his hands. "Think you so, my lord?" William asked in a level tone. "The thought had also occurred to me." "I do think so, my lord," nodded my father, as a servant came in with a plate of golden pastries of chicken breast and hog flesh. "For what other reason should the marriage be opposed? The degree of kinship between you and my daughter is distant, or at least, as my daughter has said, it is of no closer relation than you would find in any royal house in this world. There must, therefore, be another reason for the Pope to refuse. And with her usual astute grasp of such matters, my daughter speaks what is also in my mind." My father tapped the table to his side, and the servant carrying the pastries set them down, as another servant behind him put down a plate of numbles, deer innards, with wild mushrooms and butter and toasted bread to eat them on. The rich scents of buttered pastry and gamey flesh teased at my nose, but I was not hungry, in truth. Father ushered the servants away, and we were left once more in the company of each other, and the vivid fire, burning orange and red against the darkness of the night. William looked over at me. His face was gentle in the firelight, his mood now pensive, and yet the hope that shone from his eyes seemed to lighten him. "Your daughter is as wise as she is beautiful."
"And as willful as her future husband," said my father's droll voice, at which William chuckled. "Although we cannot take such a ruling lightly, my lord," continued my father, "and it will, I am sure, cause us problems. We are all agreed that this marriage and our alliance shall go ahead. Are we not?"
"Aye," William and I cried together.
"Then it shall go ahead," agreed my father, sipping from his goblet. "And we shall leave it to the offices of the next pope to sanctify the match. Such things can be done in retrospect, after all. Perhaps soon enough there may be another pope with another frame of mind on the papal throne. In the meantime, we will not be refused our natural rights by a churchman more worried for the concerns of this world than the next, and we shall defend our borders as we have always done, with vigour and honour."
William raised his goblet, and my father did too. They looked each other in the eye, and drank deeply of their wine. "But in one thing, my lords," I pointed out, "we shall be different."
"How is that, my lady?"
asked William. I smiled. "From the moment of our marriage, my lord," I replied smoothly, "Flanders and Normandy will stand together. Whosoever makes enemies with one, make so with both. We shall see who dares to stand against the might of our countries when they are joined in marriage, in law, and in war." My father chuckled.
"You would have been a fine general, my daughter."
William just regarded me with eyes brimming with satisfaction. Our marriage was set, and no one was going to stand in our way. Chapter 10. The Border of Normandy and Flanders, 1051. On my wedding night, I sat waiting for my husband in the grand bed granted to us by my parents, listening to the approaching sound of cheering and ribald jests. I looked at the ornately carved vines and heads on the bedposts, and thanked God for the curtains drawn about me. It was part of the traditional raucous ceremony to have the bride taken to bed first by her ladies, told of her duties and what horrors or pleasures she might expect that night, and then the husband was brought up by his men later, carried on the shoulders of his knights, and usually deep into his drink. Fortunately for me, William was not a heavy drinker.
Long years of watching every shadow for assassins had left him with no desire to be dead drunk when his enemies arrived to try to murder him. For me, at least, this meant a groom who had drunk sparingly at his own wedding feast. A happy choice for a virgin on her wedding night. Most maids had to endure a man sodden with ale, pawing at them, and taking small care whether they were hurt as he battered between their thighs, before passing out on top of them. I was to be spared such an ungracious, humiliating, and painful entrance to the state of marriage. I was one of the few, and fortunate, whose husbands took care of their wives' pleasure, as well as their own. The day had been beautiful. Our ceremony at the Notre Dame Dieu was attended by the Flemish court and that of Normandy. William and I were dressed in matching cloaks of gold and silver cloth, embroidered with the sign of the cross, creeping vines of flowers and encrusted in precious gems. We sparkled before the crowds that came to watch us wed. The Pope had not relented, but happily his influence did not spread so far from Rome that there were not bishops aplenty willing to please the lords of Flanders and Normandy by joining our houses in marriage. There had been quite a few who volunteered, knowing that they would secure the favour of my father and William by doing so. It made me want to roll with mirth, to think of the Pope gnawing at his own skirts in frustration, that his own bishops would flout his will by doing ours. Let him berate and rage against us. I would defy any who stood in my way. Amongst perhaps 100 new faces that day, I had met William's mother, Lady Erleva of Falaise, with her husband, Erluon de Conteville, Viscount of Conteville, whom she had married many years ago upon the death of her lover, Robert of Normandy. Even in her advanced age, I had never seen a woman of greater beauty. Not even Emma had been as breathtaking as Erleva was. If I was not shining with the grace of youth, I wondered if I could have compared to her, and I was hardly one to lack confidence in my own looks. She was a little taller than me, with golden red hair, streaked with silver, and it was silver rather than grey. It shone in the sunlight. Her eyes were large, blue, bright, and clear, her skin unmarked. She had large, sensuous lips, and delicately arched eyebrows. She moved with grace and held herself like a queen, even though she had been born to peasant stock. Erleva wore little in the way of ornament or gems, but a golden disc with the image of Saint Bartholomew lay against the creamy skin at her neck. The patron saint of tanners, Bartholomew clearly held a link to her origins, which she was still pleased to remember. She was gentle and kind, but I got the impression that there was a rod of iron hidden well inside her kitten-soft exterior. She spoke to me warmly and, much like many of those close to us, expressed some surprise at the marriage. "Your son is the strongest man I have ever known." I pressed her hand and gazed at her with serious, honest eyes. "But, since I accepted his hand, I have also found him to be the most loving. In whatever unconventional way we came to be together, we were meant to be together. Of that much I am sure, my lady." She smiled gratefully at me, and the touch of anxiety which had hovered in her eyes seemed to dissipate. "The lords of Normandy were ever an unconventional line of nobility," she mused, pressing her warm hand gratefully over mine. "So, perhaps you are right, my lady." Later in the day, William told me she had talked to him most sternly about our wedding night. For what purpose? I asked. He looked bashfully at me, a most unusual expression for him. My mouth strained not to laugh at such a look on his face.
That I was to be gentle with you,
he whispered, his cheeks turning a delightful cherry pink.
When we are together and alone.
I spluttered with mirth, causing several of the wedding party to stare at me. Blushing, I managed to stop, but still I smiled. Your mother is kind to have a care for me under the hands of her barbarian son, my lord, I teased him.
She sees the way I look at you, and she worries I will hurt a gentle girl like you in my passion.
I lifted my eyebrows in mock surprise.
It is a good thing that your mother does not know all that you do about me, my lord, I whispered. I would not want her to form an ill opinion of me. But I am no gentle girl.
He laughed. The feasting continued into the night. In the center of my father's great hall, a fire blazed, sending smoke billowing to the rafters and out through the ceiling. Rich tapestry showing scenes from the Bible and of hunting scenes were hung over every wall to demonstrate my father's wealth and, more practically, to keep the draughts out. Tables made of long wooden planks were brought to rest on wooden trestles to be dismantled when we came to dance, but hold the food as we feasted. Our table was at the head of the room, of course. We sat on chairs with backs, arms, and cushions, as the other guests sat upon long benches or banquettes. Long sideboards on each side of the room held cooked food, wine, and large communal goblets, to be taken up and served as required. A large decorated screen hid the passageway to the kitchens, and above was the gallery where the minstrels sat playing on harps and flutes, so that music floated over us. I looked over the great show of wealth, giggling as the fools came to prance and leer before me. Tumblers performed in the center of the great hall as we ate, talked, and laughed. There was a great deal of drinking going on. My father had ordered hundreds of barrels of rich wines of Gascony, crisp whites from the Rhine, and sweet reds of Greece and Castile. There was ale flavored with heather and herbs, tart sweet raspberry wine, and crisp perry. Mead flowed too, sweet and earthy as it poured down the eager throats of the company, as the many diners below us called again and again for more ale and wine. We feasted on so many dishes that I thought the tables would collapse, or the bellies of the company might explode. There was venison with frumenty, roasted head of boar carved delicately by noble pages, whole haunches of roasted meats, suckling pigs and griddled quail. There were pottages of trout and carp, pink shrimp and slippery oyster, chicken and almond milk, and stews of mutton, hog, and beef. There were whole swans, redressed in their own feathers, and with their beaks twisted about, so that it looked as though they but slumbered upon the table. Heron, crane, and duck sizzled as their roasted bodies were carried through the air on giant platters. Pies of larks, sparrows, and pigeon puffed heavy, savory steam from the marks of the kitchen knives stabbed into their round bellies. Boiled lobster and quivering stacks of baked oysters and mussels clicked merrily as they were placed on the tables. Huge fish, roasted with their heads upon them, were surrounded by other, smaller fish, as though they still swam in the water, were laid before us. Capons with orange slices, sturgeon in vinegar, pike in white powder sauce, and fried whiting, smothered in cloves and mace, glistened under the light of the torches. Fish stew with galangale, rich, tender beef with peppery coubet berries, hare in syrup of sugar of Cyprus, humble pie stuffed with succulent deer intestines, porridge, thyme and marjoram, and mutton steaks with roasted purple-white turnips made the diners cheer. We watched the mummers and tumblers perform and listened to the music playing overhead. The fire crackled and spat, and there was everywhere the sense of merriment, as fruits of plums and honey, blondelet and mulberries and cinnamon and sugar, bright imported pomegranates, and figs and cream were served to us. I was already full, even though I had sampled only a taste of each dish. Then hippocras and hard cheeses came, along with tiny wafers stamped with the arms of Normandy and Flanders, and rich honey-egg tarts, slippery with sweetness. Finally, it was time for my ladies to take me to my wedding bed. As William kissed me before I left the great hall, I bent down to his ear. "Don't be too long, my lord," I said, and he shook his head, his eyes alight with elation. Through all that long day, although I had reveled in becoming his wife finally, there was but one thing I thirsted for, and finally was to have: a husband in my bed. They brought him into the chamber after my mother and her women had impressed, long and darkly, upon me that I was unlikely to enjoy this night, but must lie back, bear the pain, and all would become easier with time. They washed me, anointed my skin with perfumed oils, and offered much sage advice. I nodded to all their warnings, but I was not afraid. I had borne pain before, and did not shy from it. No matter what came of this evening, I had long yearned to know the touch of William's hands on my skin. I burned for him. They put me into the bed and drew the curtains about me. Leaving me with whispers of comfort, they left the room. I waited. I heard the approach of the men bearing my husband to my bed long before they were anywhere near my chamber. A sound of drunken howls of gaiety, edged with a slight malicious enjoyment of inflicting embarrassment on a new couple, echoed through the halls of the castle. There was a great roar from outside the chamber. The door burst open, almost shattering from its hinges, as William's men and my father's marched into the chamber. They had William hoisted up on their shoulders and carried him to the foot of the bed, with many ribald jests and gales of bellowing laughter. I sat behind the curtain as they stripped William to his linen under-tunic, and then pushed him towards me. I lay in the bed, in only my own shift, thanking the Almighty again for the curtains pulled around the bed for modesty, as the lords and nobles made lewd and unruly gesticulations, indicating what William was to do next. "If I have anything to do with this," I thought, gazing through the gap in the curtains at them cavorting like drunken hogs, "then such as that will not be what is done in this room." They leaned on each other, almost weeping for mirth at William's dry expression as they deposited him and bowed clumsily to me, many of them reeling and staggering in their drunkenness. "Thank you for your help, my lords," William said, as they deposited him. "I believe I will be able to take the matter from this point on, without your aid." His lords bellowed with mirth, but thankfully left rapidly, some to drink even more than they had already in the great hall, and others, no doubt, to listen at the door and overhear what went on in the bedchamber of the newly wedded couple. My parents, in their wisdom, had not insisted that our first sexual encounter be observed by the nobles of the court, as was often the way. Many a poor princess had to endure the whole court leering at her as a husband took her maidenhead. My parents were happy enough to trust that my lord would bed me, and the proof would be seen when the sheet of our wedding night was displayed to the court the next day. William righted himself and walked to the bed. Pulling back the gauze curtain, he sat on the bed and lowered his top half across my lap as I sat up in bed, smiling at him. "Wife," he said with warm affection, and reached out a hand to my face. "Husband," I nuzzled the hand that stroked my skin. "Have they gone?" I whispered, speaking of the men outside the door. William turned his head and listened. Distantly, we could hear the sound of many bodies making their way noisily down the stone stairs, heading back to the great hall to feast and drink more. There was a huge crash, as one of the inebriated guests evidently tumbled down the castle stairs, and his fall was accompanied by much laughter. William turned to me and nodded, smiling. "I think they are all gone." "Good." I stroked the hair from his forehead. "I do not wish any others to come between us on the first night we are together." "Nor I," he murmured. William pulled himself up and moved over me, so that his body was over mine, but held aloft from my body by his strong arms. I let my hands wander over those arms, feeling the muscles, tracing the many silver scars of battle that covered his skin. We did not talk. I could feel my heart racing. Gently he lowered himself to me and kissed me. Our kiss seemed to melt the tension between us, the nerves and the fears. I felt his body move against mine through the covers, and I felt his hardness against my thigh. My hands roamed through his hair and pulled him closer to me, as his moved from my face to my breasts, pulling at the lacing that covered them. My breathing quickened as his lips moved downwards to kiss and suck at my breasts. I let out a moan as my body seemed to respond of its own accord to the stroke of his hands and tongue. He knelt up suddenly and pulled the night shift from his body so that before me I could see all of him. His strong chest covered in but little hair, his smooth, muscled arms, the scars on his body from conflict, and, of course, the source of his desire. I had never seen a man's body before, but the sight did not scare me. I was already deep into the spell of him, and seeing his naked body only made me want him more. I reached out and pulled him to me, whispering his name. He fell on me with eagerness, pulled away the covers and wrenched my night shift down, over my shoulders and down my legs, until we moved against each other, naked skin on naked skin. I could feel his eagerness, and I understood what he wanted. I wanted him to enter me, but I was also wary of the pain. The married women who served my mother had spoken about the things which happen between a man and wife in bed, and every one of them said the first time was not pleasant for a woman. But so far, they were wrong. I stirred my legs under him so that his body moved between them, and as he felt me raise my hips to him, I heard him gasp as he struggled to control his keenness. "Wait!" He slipped his fingers into his mouth, wetting them. "It can hurt the first time," he said, panting a little. "But I can make it better." His hand moved between my legs and into the secret parts of me. The moistness of his fingers started to rub gently and smoothly against me, finding a tiny nub between my legs that I had barely known existed. At first, I wanted to giggle, but then I had to grip his shoulders as a feeling of deep and exciting pleasure started to thrill over my skin and through my blood. Back and forth his clever fingers went, exploring me, stimulating me, as I moved against him, moaning. I knew not what he did to me, but it was enough to remove all thoughts from my mind and give myself wholly to the enjoyment of the pleasure he gave me. My mouth pressed to his. Tiny light seemed to explode over my skin and through my flesh. I moaned his name as I opened my legs wider and pushed myself into his hands. I could hear him panting at my shoulder, trying to hold back from his own pleasure, but I did not want that. My hands moved to his buttocks, where I pressed him closer to me. Try as he might, William could not resist when I sanctioned him, urging him to enter me. But he was careful, still moving his fingers on that little nub between my legs, which caused such pleasure. He started to enter me slowly and gently. Little by little, my husband pushed inside me, and although it was a strange sensation, and it hurt, the overwhelming feeling of ecstasy he had awoken in me was enough to envelop the pain in the astonishing blanket of feelings I experienced. I could feel the gratification of him inside me, feel the thrill of his pleasure as it beat against mine, and finally understood all those slight touches and sparks that had passed between us, all those small indications that when we came together as man and wife, it would be incomparable. William was struggling still to rein himself in, to not give away to the full force of his passion and hurt me, but I felt almost as though my body was gone, and I was riding on a great horse that filled my body with rapture. As he moved his hands to my body, taking hold of my sides and starting to push into me with more force and speed, my whole form seemed to explode in a rush of bliss. I called out his name in faint, breathy cries, which only seemed to spur him on in his excitement. The world around me disappeared. I was lost in a sea of exhilaration, pain, and pleasure, all mingled into one. I felt as though I had lost control of my body, of my mind, and all there was this pleasure, deep and surreal, and overwhelming all my senses. He thrust into me faster and faster. I could feel the pain no more. I was floating on a wave of pleasure. I clung to him, as dazzling lights burst all through my body and blood. I had never felt so alive as I did at that glorious moment. Finally, he stiffened, and I felt him spill his seed. He collapsed on top of me, the two of us panting and sighing as we lay in each other's arms, covered in the sweat of our passion. As he lay on me, breathing heavily into my shoulder, I kissed his neck. He moved to prop himself up on one arm, looking down at me with a lazy, contented expression. "Is it always like that?" I asked. My eyes felt as though they were covered in a filmy daze of wonder as I blinked at him. "Did you not enjoy it?" he asked, suddenly looking anxious. "Did I hurt you?" I laughed and shook my head. "I have never felt anything like it," I breathed. "It hurt a little, but nothing like the other maids said it would. They said that a woman finds no pleasure in her marriage bed on the first night. They were most wrong, my lord." William kissed me. He looked mightily pleased with himself. "Most husbands are perhaps rougher with their wives on the first night," he said. "But I was warned, remember, to be gentle with you." I chuckled. "You were not that gentle, my lord husband," I teased. But I did not mind. He rolled from me. We pulled the covers back over us and blew out the candles. The fire burned, a glowing light dappling the shadows of the chamber with dancing hues of red. He lay on his back, and I curled about him, putting my head to his chest, listening to the pounding of his heart. Between my legs was sore and bruised. I knew that the blood of my lost maidenhead was smeared on the sheets under us, but my body felt relaxed, sated.
"William,"
I whispered, as we started to fall asleep.
"Huh?"
The sleepy voice of my husband came from deep within the pillows. "They will not be expecting us in the Great Hall until late tomorrow." In the darkness, I heard him chuckle, and I smiled as my body fell into the arms of sleep, thinking of all the pleasure yet to come with the clever fingers, hands, and other parts of my new husband. Chapter 11. The Border of Normandy and Flanders, 1051. When William left our bed the next morning, after a long and sweet morning where my clever husband showed me more uses for his battle-worn hands, my mother and my ladies came to the room to help me rise. Warm, steaming, herb-infused water was brought in, carried in many huge leather buckets from the kitchens, and my ladies bathed me. Parts of me which were sore and bruised from the passion of my new lord's embraces winced at the hot water as I lowered myself into the bath. I shuddered lightly in pain as the water flowed about me, wondering ruefully if my lower regions were ever going to feel comfortable again, and then let out a sigh as I felt the herbs start their work on my body. I looked over my arms and saw small bruises from where William's fingers had dug into my skin in the midst of our delight in each other, and I smiled, remembering with a sharp, pleasurable quiver to my loins and my stomach the great pleasures that he had shown me that night and morning. I had enjoyed it even more the next day, even though I was sore and swollen. I had liked seeing the look on William's face as he thrust within me, that look of such deep concentration and fierce pleasure as he rode me. "It is a good thing," I thought, "to be a married woman." My pale skin was marked by his fingers, and my source of life was raw and tender, but I let out a sigh of satisfaction in the warm water, remembering the heat of our lust for each other. He had made me shout aloud that morning, with those clever fingers and his careful attentions. I was sure that all the servants would have heard me, but I cared not. Let them be envious for the pleasure I had found. Let them hear the cries of a woman whose lord took the time to bring her to such happiness. My mother stripped the bed and held out the wetting bedsheet between her and the maids. When I looked around, I gasped to see the brown-red stains of blood that marked the taking of my maidenhead. There were many of them, smeared all over the sheet, signaling a most enthusiastic night and morning between a newly married couple. My mother was looking at the sheet and at the marks on my body with a look of deep disapproval, but for what reason I could not fathom. "My lady mother?" I asked, in reference to her facial expression. She looked up at me with a furrowed brow, and her lips puckered. "Was he rough with you, child?" she asked anxiously, glancing again at the numerous smears and stains. I smirked with an expression of lascivious gloating, which I could not hide. I leaned back in the bath, feeling worldly and experienced now that I had become a married woman. "He was not gentle," I giggled. "But your matron said that I should find no pleasure in my first night, and they were wrong." I paused and looked at her with my eyebrows raised. "Most wrong, my lady mother," I repeated, and smiled widely at her with mischief glowing in my blue eyes. My mother looked relieved and also somewhat embarrassed at my smug expression. "Well," she said, ruffling her shoulders like an old hen caught in the rain, "in that, at least, I am glad for you, child. Some men are not gracious to their wives the first time. The Holy Virgin in heaven knows your father was not. If you have known pleasure in your wedding bed, then it bodes well for you in your marriage bed. I am pleased that your new husband took the time to please you. There are many men who would not have a mind to. The other maids were staring at me with curiosity, tittering at my words from behind the backs of their hands. I winked at them when my mother could not see me, causing more giggles, and dropped my bruised arms into the waters. Every lap of the warm, herb-infused bath was soothing. "I think so, too, Mother," I agreed, swirling the waters playfully around me. Although I will say that I am indeed sore. I felt my lower parts ache with a dull pain. "Your body will become used to it in time," she counseled, and turned to the gawping maids. "Give the cloth to my lord's servant at the door." The maids stifled their giggles and bundled up the wedding sheet, taking it to its ceremonial place in the great hall, where all would look on the stains of my lost maidenhead and see the proof of the consummation of our marriage. I smiled at the maids that remained, and their faces took on a look of admiration for me, admiration for my new status as a married woman, but combined with a clear streak of raw envy that I had so enjoyed my new husband. There would be talk amongst the servants that would spread to the nobles of how pleased the Lady Matilda was on her wedding night. That, too, gave me pleasure, for it would add to the reputation of my fine husband. "I have this for you," my mother said, as she came to the edge of the bath, holding a small earthenware pot. My maids helped me from the bath and dried my body near the blazing fire. I examined my skin to see if any of my bruises would show once my gown, sleeves, and kirtle were on, but I was satisfied that the pale beauty of my skin on show to the world would not be marred. In private, I was sure that William would not mind seeing the marks of our love on my body. After all, I had left him with marks of his own, too. "What is it?" I asked, taking the pot in my hands and opening the top. Inside was an ointment which smelt of wax and herbs. It was greasy and slick to my fingers. "A balm for a woman recently married," my mother said. "You anoint yourself with it until the time comes when your husband's zeal for your body does not cause such hurt as it does when you first pass from being a maid to a matron." She indicated where I was to spread it, and I passed my fingers over the sore parts of me, feeling comforting moisture spread over them as I did. I must have let out a sigh, for she laughed shortly. "I will give you the recipe, daughter," she said, "for it also helps a woman when she has borne children to heal and to protect those parts that are so abused by the honor of the offices we bear." "What is in it?" I asked, still spreading the skillful herbs on myself with grateful fingers. It smelt lovely, fresh and clean, and the moisture it brought to my tender skin caused the soreness to tingle and dissipate. The fire and the cloths of my women had dried my skin, and once I had spread all that I could on myself, they started to dress me and anoint my body with musky perfumes. "Angelica, beeswax, goose fat, chamomile, and honey for the main part," she said, ticking them off her fingers. "It will reduce the pain and swelling and aid healing. Use it each morning and each night when he comes to you, and you will have less pain. It will also ease his passage if you use it at night," she said with a faint blush. "After the first night, there can be swelling, which causes a woman further pain. If you use this, then you should be able to continue to find the joy in your marriage that you did on that first night. Thank you, my lady mother. I reached out to her. She took me in her arms and embraced me. She pulled back and smoothed my hair from my brow.
So young,
she murmured tenderly. And yet my little girl is an infant no longer, but a woman wedded and bedded. I will always be your child. Her face looked as though it was ready to burst with amusement.
Oh, no, my love, she laughed. You have long been a woman grown and my equal. Long have I known it. This morning only marks that which the world takes as your flowering. All of those who have known you know that you were born an adult and were never a child.
I pulled a wry face at my mother and turned to my maids, holding out my arms so they could put me in my gown. When I was dressed, I took my mother's pot of herb ointment and stored the pot beside my marriage bed. It seemed as though I was going to need it. The morning's meal was late that day, as many had celebrated late into the night. Usually, we took a light meal of ale, bread, and meat at around 10, but it was past 11 of the clock when all were assembled. As I came into the hall ahead of my ladies and mother, for now, as a duchess, I outranked all of them. There was a great cheer. I looked up, blushing, at the sight of my wedding sheet nailed to the castle walls, where all could look on the proof of the consummation of our marriage and the end of my life as a virgin. The sheet was well stained with my blood, and it was not confined to one part as some sheets I had seen in the past at such ceremonies. My blood was spread vigorously over the whole white sheet. Testament to our enthused passion in each other, both of the last night and several times from the break of dawn this morning. William and I had taken no notice of this as we were wrapped around each other in the darkness, but the sight of much blood, so widespread over the sheet, spoke volumes to those gathered at my wedding breakfast on the virility of my husband. I looked up to William at his place by my father and brothers, and saw him looking a touch bashful as the cheers went up from the lords and nobles amongst us. They applauded a nobleman using his wife well on their first night together, but they did not know the true soul of my husband, of his loving and enticing ways in the bedchamber. Glowing bright red, I walked towards my father and my husband and took my place at William's side. He greeted me by standing, kissing both my hands and my mouth as another raucous noise erupted from the crowd. I giggled, still rose red. Much wine and ale had apparently already been consumed by the wedding party, although it was still early.
"Good morning, my lady," William said as I sat down, trying not to wince as my bruised lower regions came to contact with the chair.
"My lord," I gazed at him with pleasure. I had never seen a face look more content, nor more proud as we sat together and ate as man and wife before the court. As I picked at the bread, fruits, meats, and sauces on my trencher, and conversation resumed around me, I looked up at the blood-stained sheet billowing in the draughts from the castle walls, and smiled. Although every maid had to endure the embarrassment of seeing her wedding sheet used as a wall-hanging the next morning, I came to think then that I did not mind. It was my own warrior pennant, streaming in the wind above me, in recognition of my new status. It was my own standard, my own emblem, the insignia of my new rank. I was proud of its gory visage suddenly, for it marked the passage of a girl to that of a woman. A maiden I was no longer, but a matron and a wife. I was now Matilda, the Duchess of Normandy, given in marriage to the strongest man in the world. a woman flowered and bedded, and soon I hoped to become a mother too. I passed my hand over my flat stomach and felt a skip in my heart, wondering if it was too much to hope that on this first night of being shown the promise of a whole new world of pleasures and satisfaction, I could have also conceived a child, a strong son, an heir for my husband and for myself. The first fruit of our love, and of the dynasty we would create together. Chapter 12. The Border of Normandy and Flanders, 1051. As we made preparations to move to William's capital in Rouen, word came to us that William's own uncle, the Archbishop Morger, had lifted his voice to join that of the Pope to oppose our marriage on grounds of consanguinity, stating that William and I were too closely related to be married lawfully. My new husband's own uncle was openly challenging our marriage. "Dismiss the man!" I stormed through our chambers as William read the letters to me, standing at the fire. He looked around at my angered face, and his lips trembled with the start of a grin. "Why do you smile, husband?" I asked, turning on him. "This is a most serious matter. If your own uncle stands against us, then whom are we to trust?" William laughed. It was a bold and yet bitter sound. "I smile for the love I have seen in you." He gazed at me with great affection and shook his head. "This has nothing to do with our marriage, my love. My uncle has long coveted my title. He was as wild a youth as my father, and as given to the sins of the flesh." William looked on me with sparkling eyes, lifting his eyebrows suggestively. "And those sins are not things he has been a stranger to since entering the church."
"He does this, then, as a measure simply against you, and not from any moral reasoning?" I asked, stopping in my pacing and walking to him.
"There is no moral reason against our marriage, my love," William said sincerely, his hand coming from his side to stroke at the veil that now always covered my hair. As a married woman, my glorious hair was no longer to be shown to anyone but my husband. I had sorrowed for this, but I also rather liked the fact that there was another secret part of me which William alone could know. "He wants my title. That is all. He is not the first, nor is he likely to be the last."
"And you would stand for such?" I asked in amazement. The face of my new husband darkened.
"I would have his head, if I could take it," he growled. "But as he is a servant of God, in title at least, I can do no more than denounce him and dismiss him from my service. He will wield power no more in my lands."
"Those who are not our friends are our enemies." I put my hot face to the cool linen of William's shirt, breathing out as I felt his arms surround my body.
"You are a wise wife."
He stroked my back, making shivers of excitement run through my skin.
"I am," I concurred,
as I lifted my face to his and reached up on my tiptoes to kiss him. His lips came down on mine in a rich and passionate kiss. His frustration at his uncle had fired his blood, and I felt him, hard against my body, ready to release some of that fire in me. Softly, I reached down and heard him gasp as I laced my fingers over him.
"Dismiss your uncle," I murmured,
my fingers tripping softly up and down. "And the man should think himself lucky that you do not execute him for his disloyalty."
"I will,"
William agreed. Suddenly, he tossed the missive to the floor, grabbed me by my sides, and carried me to the bedchamber.
In one strong heave, he threw me flying onto the bed and leapt upon me, already divesting himself of his tunic and undergarments in his eagerness. I opened my arms, giggling, as he leapt to me, pulling and pushing my dress up and around my waist. His impatient hands scrambled over my gown and cupped my pert breasts. The white heat of him hurt as he entered me quickly, sliding through the ointment my mother had given me. I shuddered with mingled pleasures and pains, feeling the full length of him delve deep into me. My pain numbed rapidly, and I was left with pleasure, as my body responded with greedy excitement to every motion of his body. It was quick, and it was infinitely satisfying. I had no idea that it could happen in such a way as this. Every time with William, there seemed to be something new. Afterwards, as we lay in each other's arms, I looked down at my gown bunched about my waist and the scatter of his rumpled clothes on the floor and laughed.
"What is it?"
William asked, from my side where he was nestled, one hand inside my dress, fondling my breasts.
"One would not think we were Duke and Duchess of Normandy," I observed.
"For you take me sometimes like I was a wench in an alley, my lord."
"I did not notice a complaint at the time, milady."
He drew languid eyes up to look at my face.
"It was not a complaint," I kissed him. "Merely an observation." "Good," he approved. "For I like the way we are together, all the ways we are together, fast and slow, at night and in the day. Every time I think I am sated, I have only to look on you, and I want you again. You make me feel quite wild, my love. I wonder that I can behave like a cultured lord before your father's court. I like all that we are, together."
"I do too, my lord." I reached down to cup him in my hands. He grinned as my fingers found a tired spark of interest still present in him.
"We were meant for each other,"
I whispered, moving my fingers on him and watching as he grew in my hands. We had only been married for a week, but I was ever a swift pupil, and I was fast learning how to please my husband as he pleased me. His face softened as he unlaced my dress fully and stroked a hand over my white skin.
"No one will stand against us, Matilda," he said,
pulling my gown from me. I struggled eagerly out of it and lay under him, my skin sliding against his. I opened my legs to him eagerly as he slipped inside me. We both exhaled in the arrival of another pleasure so soon after the first. He kissed me.
"No one,"
he repeated, as he once again pushed his full length into my eager and waiting body. Chapter 13. Rouen, Normandy, 1051. Archbishop Morge was dismissed from my husband's service due to devoting himself more than was usual to go cockfighting, hunting, and spending the treasures of his church on lavish hospitality, as it is said in William's proclamation. I only wished that the man was not a prince of the church, otherwise we could have taken his head for his insolence and paraded it before the gates of Rouen Castle. But, as it was, I had to make do with his disgrace. He left William's capital, Rouen, blustering, claiming he would see us excommunicated for our sins. But William and I just laughed.
"When we come to found and build the churches and abbeys that our country needs," William said, "we will see the Pope make an about turn in his policy towards us. For what buys a pope's goodwill better than advancing the riches of his church?"
I kissed him heartily. My mother looked shocked at his words, but I understood the truth in them. If we could not convince the church of the righteousness of our marriage, then we would buy its favor instead. That was the way the church worked, after all. The church was as much a merchant as any fishwife hawking her trade on the street. All bishops and popes obeyed currency and riches over supposed ideals and morals. William and I, accompanied by my parents, left for Rouen later that week. William was keen, I think, to show off his foremost city to both his new duchess and his new allies. We rode in a great procession of wagons and horses, servants and guards, musicians and nobles, and all the way we were a merry party. We slept in tents and feasted under the glittering stars. William seemed to be enjoying his new role as a husband and a lover deeply. And for me, each night in our tent, upon our bed of furs, became more pleasurable and more addictive than the last. There came jests from our nobles that we rarely saw the dusk or the dawn in other company. So eager were we to get to bed together, and so reluctant to rise. William laughed with good humor at this, as I blushed and cast down my eyes, as a woman should. But it was true enough. There were not enough hours in the night for all the time we wished to spend with one another and exploring each other's bodies. I felt pain no longer in our union. There was only pleasure, and my husband was so talented and so eager to please me that it was all I could do not to wander about the camp each day with a dazed smirk upon my lips. We came to Rouen, Normandy's capital, through a lush valley of verdant forests, surrounded by fresh green hills covered in flowers. The glittering river Seine flowed at its side, its water like a cascade of diamonds and sapphires, tumbling over rocks and breaking in small waves against the muddy, slippery edges. Hares raced over the horizon, their long-limbed, lithe forms dancing dark against the skyline. Birds shrieked and plunged in the air. There was a sweet scent of summer on the wind, and I was so happy that everything looked more beautiful to me than even it was. That is what the first flush of love can bring to a person, to look on the world with love flowing through one's blood, and to see everything anew and fresh for it. The great gates of the city groaned loud as they opened to us, and we were met by a surprise of cheering and screaming from inside. The streets were filled with people, every one of them jumping, cheering, waving, and shouting to us in a torrent of noise so loud that I felt as though I had lost all other senses in the din. I looked at William and saw him grin at me. He had arranged an entrance for his new duchess like no other, and he was pleased that I had not realized what he was up to. I threw back my head and laughed merrily, reaching down to take a present of fine linen and silk from a merchant, and speaking gentle words to him of thanks. The merchant stammered his thanks and fell back, and I saw William look satisfied that the man had paid me due respect. William held up a hand, and instantly there was silence. Such was the power he had over his people. In his presence, they were always looking to him for his lead.
"I have returned, good people," he cried in a great booming voice that rang from the battlements and sung from the walls. "And I have brought to you my wife, the noble and gracious Lady Matilda of Flanders, now your own Duchess of Normandy."
As he finished his sentence, the crowds exploded into shouting and cheering. Flowers suddenly seemed to rain from the skies. I looked up to see women with baskets of fresh blooms, flinging them from the battlements of the city wall above us, so that they fell on us in a beautiful shower of scent and color. I had never been a woman of sentiment, but the efforts that my new husband had gone to welcome me to my new home
made tears well in my eyes. William glanced at me, a crease of worry on his brow.
"You are not pleased, my lady?"
I looked around at the hundreds of cheering people, the blue, white, yellow, and pink flowers falling, fluttering over my hair and clothes with their soft beauty. I looked back at the glittering river, the thick forests, and the flowing hills. I looked into the eyes of a city built on wealth and commerce, on trade and merchant wiles. This was a city that was both beautiful and strong in its wealth and power. I reached out and stroked his arm.
"I could not be more pleased," I said happily.
"My lord." William's face broke into its lopsided grin. I saw his captains looked relieved, and the faces of the mayor and the sheriffs clear, as though a terrible fear had been taken from them. I smiled even wider, thinking that if I was ever displeased in my new home, there would not be a lack of volunteers eager to make me happy again. They feared William, even as they respected him. As long as William loved me, they would do all they could to please me. It was deeply satisfying to me. As we rode into my new, beautiful home, with my lord riding at my side, pointing out this feature and that, I could imagine no time when he would not love me, and I would not love him as deeply in return. Chapter 14. Rouen. Normandy. 1051 to 1052. Many weeks passed in the beauty of Rouen. William and I became inseparable, walking, riding, and hunting together in the day, and at night, encased in each other's arms, lost in our eagerness for each other, as the darkness stretched long and deep about us. After Rouen, we left to progress around the other cities and the towns of the duchy, and at each port and castle, the people of Normandy threw open their homes and their hearths to honor their lord and a new lady. We traveled to Falaise, the castle of William's birth, to Bayeux, where his brother Odo ruled, to the beautiful castle of Bonneville-sur-Touc, and to Caen. Caen's ducal palace dominated the skyline. Enclosed by a thick stone wall, the castle held a tower gateway, suites of rooms for William and me, and a vast great hall. Our chambers were above the hall, and were warm, safe, and luxurious, with tapestry upon the walls and furs and fleece upon the bed. Although I had thought my father's castle in Bruges fine,